University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Winona LaDuc, president of the Indigenous Women's Network, and her lecture, A Native American Perspective, Challenging the Effects of Colonialism and Industrial Thinking. LaDuc's lecture will explore a variety of topics, including the relationships between colonialism and environmental degradation, repression of Native people, resurgence of Native culture, changes forced on Native American culture by colonialism, and relationships between culture, economy, and the environment. The Indigenous Women's Network is a continental group of Native women and organizations that work actively in their communities on issues of social change, the environment, treaty and land rights, and women's concerns. Described as a leader in the fight to overcome the environmental, social, and economic plight of the vast majority of Native Americans, LaDuc lives between James Bay in northern Canada and the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. She holds a bachelor's degree from Harvard University and a master's from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and has published extensively on Native economic development, the environment, and legal issues related to Native affairs. LaDuc also serves as director of the White Earth Land Recovery Project, which coordinates development of an overall land acquisition, negotiations, and consolidation program for the White Earth Band of Chippewa Indians. She has represented Indigenous peoples at a variety of United Nations international forums and was the winner of the 1988 Reebok Human Rights Award. Join us now for University Forum and Winona LaDuc.
Aneen, that's how I say hello in my language. Is there a way to keep this from buzzing? Is there anything I do? Who's in charge here? Oh, you guys? Okay. Well, anyway, you take charge. Sure, it'll be okay. When they introduce you, it always sounds like you want a job. Read your resume. I'm employed. I have a job. I want to thank you for inviting me, and I want to thank you for coming today to hear me talk. Aneen is how we say hello in my language. I'm from the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. I'm the Bear Clan, Makwa Dodam of the Mississippi Band of Anishinaabeg. Anishinaabeg is how we call ourselves in our language. We're called Ojibways in Canada, and we're called Chippewas in the United States. And just to kind of locate myself geographically for y'all, because I know you know lots about Indians, I'm going to say that our traditional territory is the northern part of four American states and the southern part of four Canadian provinces. We still inhabit that today. We're the single largest Native population in North America, but we're on both sides of the border, so people don't usually consider us that. But there's actually more of us than there are, for example, Navajos. What I'm going to talk about today is that conquest cannot be sustained. I'm going to talk about the idea of the quincentennial, the 500 years, as the end of time to begin with the end of conquest and the beginning of survival. And I'm going to talk about those issues from an Indigenous perspective. Before I forget, I got a couple things up here. There's some brochures on my project that I put at both ends of the stage. I always forget this, so I have to say it at the beginning. And this is a poster, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later. To begin with, I'm going to give you four images of Native people in recent years to give you a context of Native resistance to colonialism, Native resistance to America, and why that exists. The first image is a woman named Catherine Smith. She's 72 years old. She's Diné, or Navajo. She lives in a place called Big Mountain, and she's engaged in... She lives in a traditional way. And she's looking at a fencing crew that was sent by the Bureau of Indian Affairs under a congressional law to put a fence through her land and subsequently to relocate her. She's looking at this fencing crew and telling them that they can't go on her land. And they keep coming on her land. And at night, she goes out there with other women and she takes down the fence that they put up. And then in the morning, the fencing crew comes back. And at a certain point, Catherine Smith takes her shotgun out and fires two warning shots over the head of the fencing crew. That's the first image, Catherine Smith. The second image is a woman named Mary Pasteen. She's 82. I prefer older women. Mary is an Innu woman in northern Labrador, or Nistassinan, as the Innu call it. And she's looking at about a 550-ton fighter jet that's coming down a runway at her. And she's standing on the runway. The third image is a woman named Carrie Dam, who is a Shoshone woman. And she's about 65. She lives in Nui Segovia, or what is called Nevada by the United States. And she's a rancher. And she's lived in the same place that their family has lived there for probably thousands of years. And she's looking at a BLM, Bureau of Land Management. Y'all hear of them before? Yeah. This is the West, I guess you get BLM out here. And she's looking at some BLM guys that are trying to take her cattle. The year is 1992. And the fourth image is a guy named Milton, born with a tooth. And he's Blackfeet, Indian guy. He lives in southern Canada. And he's standing on top of a bulldozer in southern Alberta. Those are four images of Indigenous people in 1989 to 1992 that I'm going to talk about in this context. But to begin with, what I want to do is give you a little bit of context for Indigenous values and the values of conquest. I'm going to suggest to you that Indigenous people are the only people who have the experience of living sustainably on this land. And that when there is discussion now in international circles and at the UN Environmental Conference of sustainable development, I'm going to suggest to you that the only people that have the experience of living sustainably are in fact Native in the Western Hemisphere. And that is perhaps something to consider when we look at embracing each other and look at the next 500 years. I'd like to talk a little bit about the values which make community sustainable. I'm going to suggest that development is not sustainable, that community is sustainable, though. And that perhaps needs to be what we look at. And I'm going to talk about those from an Indigenous perspective. But before I do that, I'm going to ask y'all a question to see if you have to have the long speech or the short speech. And I guess you're going to have a long speech. Now, you're all smart, right, because you're here at university. And you're in the middle of Indian country, which I'm not sure if you know or not. I'm going to ask you 20. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to ask you how many of you could name 20 different kinds of Indigenous people in North America? How we doing? Is this easy beans? Some of you going like this. Counting on your hand, they're trying to figure it out. How many of you got past 5? Easy. Not bad. Okay, how many of you could get past 10 if I give you like 2 minutes, 3 minutes? The rest of you, where are you about? 4 or 5? 20? How many of you figure you could get 20 hands down? Easy. Easy beans. Not bad. If you're not real smart, I ask you 10. And some places, people cannot name 10 different kinds of Indigenous people. 20 is kind of a little bit of a test. But y'all didn't pass it. The reality is that there are over 700 different kinds of Indigenous people in North America. Most Americans don't know much about Indians, is my experience, which is kind of a disgrace from my perspective. But there's over 700 different kinds. There's over 200 native communities in Alaska. There's 80 in California. There's some places like the Yakima Reservation in Washington State that there's 14 different kinds of native people that live on that reservation. Colville has 11. In northern Minnesota, where my reservation is, there's 6 other Ojibwe reservations in the far north. So there's lots of Indians all over. Now, to give you a little bit of a context, what I want to say is that inside the United States, as, for example, inside the state of Nebraska, Native people live on reservations, for the most part, which are islands in a continent, if you want to look at it in that context. We're islands in a continent. But that is not indicative of our status in the Western Hemisphere. Because, for example, Canada, which is the country to the north, you all know where that is, right? 1 out of 7 Americans can't identify the U.S. on a world map, so... Canada is the country to the north, and in that country, when you go north of the 50th parallel, which is around Edmonton, when you go north of the 50th parallel in Canada, which is the upper two-thirds of the Canadian landmass, the majority population is Native, 85%. of the north of Canada, or the upper two-thirds of Canada, the majority population is Native. So in a northern continental perspective, the fact is that Native occupancy of the continent is about a third of the continent. A third of North America is occupied by Native people. And that doesn't even include places like Navajo Reservation of the Southwest. And if you look at it in a Western Hemisphere perspective, what you need to understand is places like El Salvador, Guatemala, Peru, Bolivia, and Ecuador, the majority population is Native. So, in fact, Native people remain a significant part of the Western Hemisphere. We remain here in a significant presence 500 years later, and I would suggest the reality is that we intend to stay around. Now, to look at it, to look at values in that context, that's what I want to talk about. I want to say that in not knowing much about Native people, most people don't know much about Indigenous values, or the values which have made our society sustainable. And I'm going to talk about those because it is my suggestion that perhaps some of the values which have made our society sustainable for thousands of years are values which may provide some insight to Americans. I'm going to talk about our values, and then I'm going to contrast them with the values of this culture because I think that they're very different. And I'm going to suggest that very much the conflict which exists today in North America and on a worldwide scale is the conflict between the Native and the settler, and that it is perhaps in that context that we need to begin to look at things. And perhaps my suggestion is that the settler needs to ally with the Native, and that is the challenge that we face in America. Our values and our ability to live here are based on certain premises. In my culture, Anishinaabe culture, and in many other Indigenous cultures, it is my experience that we hold certain laws to be preeminent. The reality is that in my community, we have a perception that natural law is preeminent. It is superior to the laws made by states, made by nations, made by counties, made by municipalities, made by corporations, that natural law is the preeminent law, and that communities, nations, and individuals are all accountable to natural law. That is our perception, is that natural law is preeminent. And in order to live in accordance with natural law, we've done a whole lot of things, because what we figure is that that is the easiest way to survive, is to come in accordance with natural law. And that is what our practices of sustainability are about. It is also our interpretation of how natural law works that enables us to do things. For instance, in our perception that natural law is preeminent, we have come to recognize that most things which are natural are in cycles. They are cyclical. The seasons, the moons, the tides, our bodies, all of those things which are natural are cyclical. And it is the perception of many Indigenous people, and in my community included, that time is also cyclical. Because of that, we have a perception that what you do now will affect you. It will impact on you, and that you are responsible for it, because you are the same people that continue for generations. We also have a whole way of living that brings us in accordance to natural law. In my community, we have a language, Anishinaabe, and in our language we have a term which is Minobamatasiwin. Minobamatasiwin. It means the good life, and the alternate translation is continuous rebirth. It is the code of ethics which holds the social fabric and the behavior of our community together so that we live in accordance with natural law. It is how we treat each other according to this code of ethics, and how I strive to live as an individual, and how also I strive to live within the ecosystem. Now, within our value system, we also have other perceptions. For instance, in my language, Anishinaabe, in my language, most of our nouns are animate, or a great number of our nouns are animate. And because of that, for example, mandamin, corn, is animate. Manoman, rice. Sema, tobacco, is animate. A sin, a stone, is animate. In my language, all of those things are animate. And because of that, what we have is a perception that those things are alive. They have spirit. And they have standing on their own. And so because of that, when I go to harvest something for my ecosystem, I recognize that they are animate, that they are alive, and they have spirit, and I must reckon with them. So what we have in our way of living is a concept that anthropologists term reciprocity, which means that when I harvest, I live in a land-based economy. In my community, 75% of our people hunt for big, you know, for deer. Take one or two animals. Most of the same amount of people hunt for smaller animals. About 50% of our people harvest wild rice for our own use and for sale. A good portion, about the same number, garden. Go to sugar bush, harvest medicinal plants, harvest berries, harvest basket materials for their own use and for sale. We have an economy which is very much based on the land, which I'd suggest actually most economies are. But in order to live in accordance with this Minobamatasiwin and this perception of things as being animate, we have come to terms with things in this concept of reciprocity, which means that when I harvest from the ecosystem, when I take wild rice on my reservation, when I go out and harvest wild rice, which is what I do, I always give when I take, which is what reciprocity is about. I always give sema, tobacco, is the offering that we make in return for harvest of wild rice. So I always give both to the rice itself, which is animate, and to the Creator to give thanks for giving to me that which sustains me. It is a reciprocal agreement in which I always give when I take. And I always understand that within this code of ethics that I only can take what I need and I must leave the rest. That is the essential practice, which is that you always give when you take. Reciprocity, and you only take what you need and you leave the rest. Because if you take more than you need and you do not leave the rest, or you do not give when you take, then according to my instructions, I am out of order with natural law. I'm out of order with my practices, and I have violated my part of my responsibility with my ecosystem. Now, I told you about all those things because I want to contrast them with the values that I'm going to suggest permeate industrial culture and permeate the society. I talked about them because I think y'all probably hadn't heard about those values before. Is that probably right? Do you ever hear most of this stuff before? I think that they're different from American values or the values that permeate this culture, and I'm going to suggest to you a couple of reasons why. To start with, I think that industrial values have a perception of man's dominion over nature. That there is a perception that man is superior to nature and that man has dominion over nature, which I would suggest is different than our perception of natural laws being preeminent, that we view things a little bit differently. A second perception that occurs in this culture is a perception of linear thinking. I went through all the way through school in this country, and time... For instance, in this country, y'all know how time is taught, right? It's taught on a timeline. And it's usually a timeline which begins around 1492 and continues from there on out, right? This is how it's usually taught. And there's certain dates which are marked on that timeline which are important to someone. And that's kind of how the timeline works. Now, I'm going to suggest that that is linear thinking about time, which is quite a bit different than cyclical thinking about time. And I'm also going to suggest that perhaps there are certain values and precepts associated with this way of thinking that permeate our culture. For example, an idea of primitive and civilized. That some peoples are primitive and some peoples are civilized. And the idea is that people want to be civilized. That there is wild which needs to be tamed. Or needs to be cultivated. And notions, for instance, of progress, a society defined by the intent on progress. Progress defined by things like technological advancement and economic growth. Those being indices of progress. Those being things that you want to have, that you want to strive for. I'm going to suggest also that perhaps some of those perceptions restrict the ability of people in this society to view the world and other peoples. For example, I would suggest that the idea that some people are primitive and other people are civilized is in itself perhaps racist. Because usually what you find is a perception that people of European descent are civilized, and people of other cultures and people of color are viewed as primitive. I would suggest that those kinds of perceptions are different than the perceptions in our culture. And I'd suggest also that those are things that we need to recognize and look at. The third concept that I want to talk about in industrial culture is, now this is real unpopular to talk about, but I'm going to talk about it because I can't help myself, is I want to contrast the economic system of this country with our economic system based on Min Obamata Siwin and reciprocity. The economic system which occurs in this country is a system of capitalism. And, you know, it's not popular to talk bad about capitalism, so let's say I'm not doing that. But let's say, for instance, that, you know, I went to school in this country, and my experience is that capitalism is based on taking labor and capital and resources and putting them together for the purpose of accumulation. Is this right? You all hear this before? Labor and capital and resources, and you put them together for the purpose of accumulation. And the idea, of course, is that you take the least labor and capital and resources, and you put them together to accumulate the most. That's kind of the intent. A better capitalist you are, the least of the first three you put together, and the most you accumulate is what you're after. This idea of accumulation is what I'm going to take issue with. Because I'm going to suggest to you that the process of continuous accumulation, the intent of accumulation, the idea of having lots for yourself, is something that is not in order in our value system. In our value system, we believe in reciprocity, which is you only take what you need and you leave the rest. And we also have a perception that you must also give when you take. And that is different than a system which is based upon constant taking, continuous accumulation. And that idea of accumulation being the intent, being always to take more than you need and not leave the rest, which is what accumulation is about, is in itself, from our perspective, perhaps inherently out of order with natural law. So those are the contrasts that I wanted to make for you to begin at the outset of this. I'm going to suggest that those are differences in value systems from indigenous values and industrial values. Indigenous values based, I would suggest to you, on natural law, based on perceptions of natural law being preeminent, cyclical thinking, reciprocity, and values of industrial thinking. I'm going to suggest to you that the conflict between those values, as manifest between the conflict between the settler and the native in the Western Hemisphere, has been illustrated and manifest in very destructive ways on the continent. Now, I know y'all have had 3 or 4 lectures on Columbus, and so I'm not going to continue too much with the discussion of the impact of 500 years of colonialism. But what I do want to say is that Native people understand clearly the relationship between how a society treats the land and how it treats the people who live on the land. We understand clearly the relationship between extinction of species and extinction of peoples. And that is very much the experience of the past 500 years. In the past 500 years, we've seen the extinction of 2,000 indigenous peoples in the Western Hemisphere. And during that same period of time, actually within the last 150 years, we've seen the extinction of more species than since the Ice Age. There is a direct relationship between, in our perspective, from the extinction of peoples and the extinction of species. But what happens in this America is that we don't recognize what has happened. America is very much about that a myth, the myth of discovery, the myth of an uninhabited wilderness which was discovered and there was a manifest destiny, a God-given right of someone to claim it. And that is very much the myth of discovery and the myth of the quincentennial. That is the myth that it is essential that Americans of conscience debunk. It is an unethical myth to continue. And it is a myth which does not recognize the fullness of this history and of the potential for the future. I would suggest to you that the reality is, and I think that most of you know it by now, that the Holocaust which occurred in the Americas is unparalleled in the world. millions of people were killed. But it's not appropriate for me to say that my Holocaust is worse than someone else's Holocaust. What it is important to say is that a Holocaust occurred. We must recognize it, which America does not usually recognize. And in addition to that, we must stop the Holocaust. And that is, in my perspective, very much the challenge facing Americans of conscience. But what has occurred instead is that most Americans do not know anything about Indians, which is why I asked that question at the outset. Most Americans cannot name indigenous people in North America, because what has happened is that nobody talks about Native people in this country. And so the history is, and the present circumstances are, is that there is no victim, so there is no crime. If we do not have an Indian, nothing has occurred. And when I ask people, what kind of Indians they can name, now y'all can name Omahas and Winnebagos because you're right here in Nebraska, but if I ask people what kind of Indians they can name, you know what kind of Indians most people can name? Indians from Westerns. Because the reality is that most Americans, their entire image of a Native person is an image fabricated in Hollywood. It is an image created in a Western, and it is an image seen on TV. And that is, for the most part, their only perception of a Native person. And I would suggest to you that that is problematic. Because what that poses is that makes a Native person a caricature. We are not full human beings. We do not have the same human rights as other people. We are instead caricatures. We are very much trivialized. We exist in comics. We exist in Peter Pan cartoons. We exist in Westerns. And we exist as mascots of sports teams. So because of that, we are not full human beings, so we do not have the same standing and the validity of our human rights as other peoples. It is incumbent upon Americans of conscience to expand their understandings of indigenous people, because I will suggest to you very much that the development of the United States is contingent upon the underdevelopment of Native communities. It is a historical reality, and it is a reality which continues today. And that relationship is something that we must understand and we must take account of if we are to begin learning how to survive. I would suggest to you that this history of Holocaust and this history that has occurred until now is a history of a society based on conquest. And I would suggest to you that conquest is not sustainable. It is time instead to figure out how to live here. The centrality of indigenous people to that struggle is something which we need to address. The reality is that the environmental crisis that the world finds itself in, the environmental and economic crisis in which the world finds itself, is something which is totally related to the situation of indigenous people. It remains, as it has for the past 500 years, a situation of other people's lands, essentially, and other people's resources. The indications are, for example, that on a worldwide scale, over 50 million indigenous people inhabit the world's rainforests. They are not unpopulated, they are peopled. It's not just toucans and jaguars, it is people who live in the world's rainforests. Over 50 million. 1 million indigenous peoples are slated to be relocated for dam projects in the next decade, all the way from James Bay to India to China. There's about 135 wars going on in the world today. Those are viewed as odd shooting matches between different kinds of people. 72% of those wars that are going on in the world today are wars between nations and states. Nations of indigenous people and states as recognized by the United Nations. Those are wars in which, for the most part, those states are trying to annex the land, territories, or peoples themselves to become a part of them. 72% of the wars going on in the world today involve indigenous peoples. The vast majority of atomic weapons which have been detonated in the world have been detonated on indigenous peoples. The Soviet Union did it. Most of the world has done it in the Pacific. About 220 atomic weapons detonated in the Pacific on Pacific Islanders. And the United States does it in Nui Segovia, a place called Nevada, by the U.S., on the Western Shoshone Nation. About 650 weapons have been detonated there at about $50 million a pop. And in North American scale, those circumstances are similar. In the United States, two-thirds of the uranium resources in what is called the U.S. are on Indian reservations. One-third of all Western low-sulfur coal is on Indian reservations. Vast amounts of oil resources underlie Indian reservations. We are the people who inhabit the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which has been a centerpiece of the Bush Energy Plan, the last undeveloped part of the North Slope of Alaska. It's not unpopulated. The people who live there are the Gwich'in. They've lived there for about 9,000, 10,000 years. We are the people who have the single largest hydroelectric project in North America on our lands. The James Bay Hydroelectric Project is on our lands. We have the dubious honors of having received 15 of the 18 nuclear waste research grants for what's called MRS, Monitored Retrievable Storage of Nuclear Waste. 15 of the 18 recipients of the grants are Indian communities. And we've had about 100 separate proposals to dump toxic waste in Indian territory. That's just, of course, the beginning. But that is the circumstance in which we find ourselves. And so what I would like to suggest to you that very much America's energy policy and a great portion of America's industrial policy remains contingent upon indigenous people, remains contingent upon the exploitation or development, according to how you perceive it, of our lands and of our resources. And that is a circumstance which people of conscience and people of your age need to be concerned, because there is a direct relationship between all of us. And we are all ultimately accountable, it is my perception, for our behavior and for our consumption. I'm going to get back to those four women that I talked about, or three women and one man, at the beginning, and talk to you a little bit about their circumstances. The first woman is Catherine Smith. She's a Navajo woman. She lives at a place called Big Mountain. The Navajo Nation is a microcosm of the problem of energy development or energy exploitation in Native communities. It has a history of having, in the late 50s, been the host to uranium mining, followed by coal strip mining. Kerr McGee, a company which most people came to know through the Karen Silkwood movie, went down there under contract with the Atomic Energy Commission and opened up uranium mines. Navajo uranium miners went to work in underground uranium mines with no ventilation shafts, and they drank the water from the bottom of the uranium mines. The Atomic Energy Commission and Kerr McGee knew full well that uranium was radioactive, and the impact on those miners would be that they would probably die. That is, in fact, what happened to them. 15 years later, most of those miners who worked underground in uranium mines had died from lung cancer or from stomach cancer. The women who washed their clothes had skin cancers. And the children born at Shiprock, or who live in the Shiprock Indian Health Service District, have a birth defect rate of 8 times the national average, according to the March of Dimes. That is the impact of uranium mining in a microcosm. The reality is, though, is that the circumstances on Navajo are much broader than that, because I used to work down there in 1978, and when I worked down there at that time, they had 42 operating uranium mines, 10 uranium mills, 5 coal-fired power plants, and 4 coal strip mines, either on or adjacent to the Navajo reservation. In 1 year, the Navajo Nation exported enough energy resources to fuel the needs of the state of New Mexico for 32 years. At the same time, 85% of all Navajo households had no electricity in them. I would suggest to you that that is an indication of a relationship very similar to this country's relationship with third world countries. It is also indicative of an unequal relationship, and that the Navajos are required or forced to bear the burden of an American energy policy, which destroys their land, their ecosystem, and impacts on their health. Navajos were paid about 60 cents a pound for uranium that was going for $40 a pound on the market, and 15 cents a ton for coal that was going for about $20 a ton on the market. The prices paid were not ethical prices. But it is not really an issue of how much you pay someone. It is an issue of the effect. It is an issue of if those people have a right to say no. It is an issue of if uranium mining is ethical at all. I would suggest perhaps that it is totally unethical. That is why women like Catherine Smith were engaged in a resistance. Because what they understood fundamentally was that their way of life, which for a very long time had been based on the land, was at risk. And that the option given to them To be paid money and to move to a city like Flagstaff was not an option, because everything that they had ever known, their entire religious system, their entire spiritual relationship to the land, their entire culture was based on that place. And to force them to move, to force them to relocate under the Relocation Act, was the choice of a death to them. Native people are not transient. They are attached to land. They do not perceive that they have a choice to move. All they perceive is that they have a choice to live. So that is the first woman, Catherine Smith. The second woman is Mary Pastine. She's the Innu woman who was looking at the fighter jet coming down the runway at her. Now, I don't know if y'all have been around low-level flying. Do they have low-level flights here in Nevada? Some of them. They go about 300 meters over the ground in their fighter jets that weigh about 30 tons. And they do this thing called buzzing, which is a test of military practice, I guess. The problem is that it's really destructive. The military is looking at it from the top down, right? But the people that are living on the ground are in a different position entirely. And so what happens is that in Northern Labrador, or Nistassinen, Northern Labrador is, now I've got to tell you all where this is probably. It's on the northeast coast of Canada. It's in the north. It's an area about the size of France that the Innu call Nistassinen, which means our land in their language, which, I figure is a pretty good name for it, being as they've been there probably about 20,000 years. The Canadian government calls it Labrador. They perceive it as uninhabited. The Innu don't consider it as uninhabited. They consider that they live there. But what happens is that in the early 50s, the Canadian government, in response to the Cold War era, opened up a military base there at Goose Bay, called Goose Bay. And they invited everybody to come test their flights there. And so they have these low-level flights, and they have bombing ranges and bombing fields. And they practice military maneuvers there, and the Germans do it, and the French do it, and the British do it, and the Americans do it. And they all come up there and test in Innu territory. Now, what happens when they have these low-level flights, for instance, is it makes you close to hysterical. It makes you fall to the ground because it causes everything around you to vibrate, and there's this huge sound. And it's very disconcerting for animals that live there as well as people. The caribou herd that is there doesn't reproduce in that area now. They have started moving out of the area, and a lot of things are affected by it. Well, the struggle of the Innu is that about 15 years ago, NATO announced that they were going to site a base there, which would have increased the number of low-level tests from 8,000 a year to 100,000 a year. And what the Innu recognized was that if they were going to increase the number of flights from 8,000 a year to 100,000 a year, life would be unbearable for the Innu, and that they couldn't continue to live there because they would be essentially in a war zone all of the time. And so these people engaged in a struggle to resist the siting of the NATO base. It started about 15 years ago. And, I'm telling you this story because these people don't have a lot of money. They weren't powerful. They didn't speak English for the most part. And what they did is they went to court. They went and testified in an environmental impact assessment process. They lobbied the Canadian Parliament. They did marches across the country. They got hauled into court. They used to get hauled into court because Mary Pastine and all her old lady friends used to go and sit on the runway or stand on the runway. And the government would come and arrest them and say that they were trespassing on their runway. And what happened is that at a certain point, the court ruled that the Innu could not have been trespassing because they actually perceived it was their land. That is indicative of the circumstances. It went on for about 15 years, and then here about 4 or 5 years ago, after a huge amount of organizing work, NATO decided not to site the base at Goose Bay in their territory. So what I wanted to say was that it is possible for people who are not viewed as being people of wealth or power in this country or in North America to resist things. because the integrity of their resistance is based on their perception that their entire way of life is at stake in these circumstances. I would suggest to you, though, that the circumstances of Mary Pastine are indicative of the circumstances of Native people across Canada. Remember I told you about how 85% of the population lives in the north? The reality is that most of the resources, most of the roads in Canada do not run east-west, they run north-south. And a great portion of the resources which are now being consumed by American utilities are coming from the north of Canada. Because what happened is that we organized to stop uranium mining on the Navajo Reservation and other places, and we organized with the anti-nuclear movement in this country. And we had actually a great deal of success, which most of you probably did not know about. There was proposed to be 1,000 nuclear power plants in the United States by the year 2000. You know how many there are now? There's about 120. They haven't had a reactor order for 14 years. And the reason that it is because people went on the streets and organized and said that this is not okay. You cannot put it in my backyard, and you can't put it in anyone else's backyard either. And so we stopped most of the uranium mining on the Navajo Reservation, for instance. In 82, almost all the mines closed down, including one at Laguna Pueblo, the largest uranium strip mine in the world. But what happened is that we did not decrease the level of consumption in this country. Consumption continued at the same rate. And so while we canceled nuclear reactor demand and orders in this country, most of the northern utilities in the United States contracted with Canada for hydroelectric power. And so we now have a huge set of dams from James Bay all the way to the Pacific Ocean, which are intended to harness the power of northern rivers in Cree, Inuit, Dene, Chippewayan, and Ojibwe territory to bring utility to northern American, to bring power to northern American utilities. The impact of that is as devastating as anything in Native communities. I want to just give you an image. In the late 70s, or in the early 70s, these guys from Hydro-Quebec came to northern Quebec, to Cree territory. And the Crees had not seen very many white people. They had seen some ministers. They had seen some teachers and some doctors. Very few. That's who Indians in the north usually get. And that's about it. All of a sudden, these guys from the south of Quebec come up and say, "Those are our rivers." And the Crees said, "What?" And they said, "No, those are our rivers, and we're gonna put dams on them." And the Crees could not believe, they couldn't even conceptualize that those rivers could belong to somebody, especially somebody that they had never seen from someplace else. But James Bay 1 was built in the 70s, and it's 5 large reservoirs, 3 power plants, producing about 10,000 megawatts of electricity. 4 rivers were diverted, and they flooded an area half the size of Lake Erie. That's how much is underwater. The area impacted is about the size of France. The impact is that you take free-flowing rivers and you turn them into toxic reservoirs. They're toxic because most of them are now contaminated with mercury at a level 6 times the allowable dosage. So you have huge reservoirs that add up to an area the size of Lake Erie, which are contaminated with mercury in a northern ecosystem. In an experiment that nobody knows the full impact of, because nobody's ever tried a set of dams in permafrost, which is what we're talking about. The Crees who live downstream have mercury contamination in their bodies. 2/3 of them have mercury contamination. And the whole ecosystem is affected by it. But what frightened most American environmentalists the most about the dams on James Bay was in 1984, when Hydro-Quebec released a flow of water precisely during the migration of the Georges River caribou herd. The effect was that 10,000 caribou were drowned at one time. Quebec Hydro called it mainly an act of God. And that is indicative of the level of callousness which exists. But the Cree understand the much larger implications, which are North American implications. Because the National Audubon Society estimates that if they are able to continue with James Bay 2, which will double the size of flooding to an area the size of Lake Erie and impact an area the size of New England, if they are able to continue with James Bay 2, then the James Bay and the Hudson Bay ecosystem will be devastated, making it uninhabitable for most of the wildlife and the birds which presently live there, which is what, of course, the Audubon Society was concerned about, since it's the central flyway for most of the migratory birds. I think the birds that go through here, the Canadian geese, do you ever see Canadian geese down here? they go to James Bay. That's their nesting ground. That is the scale of the problem with which we are faced. It's the northern equivalent to the destruction of the Amazon rainforest. And the reality is that most of the impetus is coming from America. Originally, it was contracts with New York Power Authority. But after about 4 or 5 years of organizing work, in March of this year, the New York Power Authority canceled its contract for hydroelectric power from James Bay, citing environmental reasons and economic reasons as the reasons. But what I want to say is that people got New York Power Authority to change. They went out on the streets. They talked to them. They lobbied them to get them to change. But the circumstance still remains, where northern electricity is coming to most northern utilities in this country from Canada. And I'm going to suggest to you that that James Bay situation is a microcosm of what occurs all the way across the north of Canada. And that the challenge is not only an ecological challenge, it is a social challenge. Because native communities, which have practiced a way of life for thousands of years, which I would suggest are sustainable, 75% of their food coming from the land, are being forced off the land. And so what happens, for instance, in northern Manitoba at Norway House, where they had a series of dams that went in the 70s, is that they took 634 people from a village or from an area, and they moved them into a housing project. And then those people who had before got all of their food from the land, all of a sudden the land could not support them because their ecosystem was devastated. And so they had to buy their food at the store at rates about 10 times that people in the south have to buy their food. And they saw a whole host of social problems occur. It is no coincidence why native teenagers in that village had a suicide rate 15 times the national average. Nor is it a coincidence why most of the people in that village began to suffer from the problems of substance abuse. I would suggest to you that those circumstances are the circumstances with which most of our people are faced. The challenge between industrialism and our way of life. And I would suggest to you that it is incumbent upon Americans to recognize the impact that this society has on people of different cultures, and also to recognize our responsibility. I would like to say that what we need to look at in terms of some of the future is some changes. I would suggest to you that this way of living, which causes essentially extinction of species, as well as extinction of peoples, is unethical. That the rate of extinction of native peoples continues in North America and elsewhere. The BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, can today declare a native people extinct. And the rate of extinction in the Amazon is one indigenous nation a year since 1900. It is not just about the exploitation of resources. It is also about the extinction of peoples. That our relationship as North Americans and collectively as a society needs to begin to look at that set of relationships. And if we are indeed people of conscience, we need to understand the implications for the decisions that are made in this society for other peoples. I believe quite fundamentally we also must look at if this level of extinction is sustainable. It is in fact my suggestion that this level is not, and that the challenge needs to be how we formulate a new way of looking. It is time to look from conquest to survival. The essence of that is beginning to articulate a new vision in this America. That vision very much needs to be based on building from an economy based on war to peace. An economy which is based on a wartime economy to the utilization, for instance, of a peace dividend, since there is essentially no one left to fight, I would suggest, to begin to look at utilizing that for a peace dividend. To begin to look at decentralizing energy production in this country and decreasing the level of consumption. To begin to look at ways to live with agriculture in this country, which are sustainable. To begin to look at ways to harvest timber in this country, which is not based on clear cutting, but instead is based on selective cutting. And to begin to look at the social structures and fabric of this society in a way which can be more inclusive rather than exclusive. I believe that that is some of the challenge with which we are faced as people of conscience in this country, is to begin to reformulate the vision. Because the level of ecological destruction which has occurred is not something which can continue. I would suggest that the West is a state of mind, and that there are no frontiers left. And that it is time for us all and y'all to figure out how to, instead of keep moving west, to figure out how to stay here. Because there's no place left to move to. There's no other countries left to colonize. There's no other frontiers left to take. And that ultimately, at a certain point, we have to figure out how to make things livable where we are. That is very much what that vision needs to be about. A second piece of that vision, I believe, fundamentally, is that America must recognize the indigenous issue. And people of conscience in this America must come to terms with it. It is a historical reality, and it is a present reality. The reality, though, is that most Americans, when they think of Indians, what they do is they feel guilty. And that is how most Americans think of Indians, is they feel guilty. They say, oh, what happened is bad, I feel bad about that. And that's kind of how Americans deal with the environment. They feel guilty. You know, you feel, oh, geez, I feel bad. I wish that wouldn't happen. I sure wish someone would take care of that and fix that. And I'd suggest to you that this feeling of guilt is perfectly useless. It really does no good for indigenous people. And it doesn't do anybody any good, period. And that the point and the challenge is very much how to get over the guilt. I would suggest to you that people who have engaged in some kind of work on environmental issues have come to terms with their guilt somehow. And that they have gotten from a point of being reactive about it to being able to move on environmental issues. And that is very much that same ability to get off guilt and move to something else is what we also need to be able to do on the indigenous issue. It is not about, I can say Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff, but most other people cannot say Anishinaabe. And it is fundamentally how you perceive things. But our rights to self-determination and sovereignty are the same rights of the Slovenians, the Armenians, the Serbs, and the Croatians. And they are the same fundamental rights of indigenous people. Finally, I would suggest to you that the challenge of embracing the human rights of indigenous people is a fundamental challenge to North America, but it is also very much a challenge in terms of the wider perspective that we have on where we are living. I would suggest to you that it is unsustainable to continue the level of consumption we have in this society, a society which consumes a third of the world's resources and has 6% of the world's population, requires constant intervention into other people's lands and other people's territories, whether they are Indian reservations or whether they are viewed as other countries. That level of consumption cannot be sustained because it constantly violates the human rights of other people, and it also constantly violates our ability to just live. That is very much the challenge that I believe that we face, is to decrease our level of consumption, because it's meaningless to talk about human rights if we continue consuming at the rate we do, which is very much has been our history. As a part of that, we have this campaign, which there's some posters over there, which is called Unplug North America. A lot of indigenous groups are supporting, and Greenpeace is supporting. And the intent is that we are asking people beginning in this year, one day a year, October 13th, to not consume. We thought that that would be an interesting idea, that people could not consume electricity for one day, or not consume, not drive their car, not, be as minimal as you could. And we thought that this would be an interesting exercise to all challenge our own level of essentially electrical addiction. And that it was about giving Mother Earth a rest for one day a year. So there's some posters on this if you're interested. So that's an example. But finally, I believe fundamentally the challenge facing people of conscience in this country and all of us is how to bring the society in order with natural law. I believe that ultimately we are all accountable to natural law, that ultimately the sustainability of the society is based on its ability to live within natural law, and us individually and collectively to live within natural law. I fundamentally believe that that is the challenge we face, but I also believe that is the reality which we face. And that is something which all of us will need to do. So that's what I want to say. I gather some people went to class. But I have some water here, and if people wanted to have questions or have a discussion, thank you for your time.
Today on University Forum, we've heard Winona LaDuke, president of the Indigenous Women's Network. Her lecture was entitled, A Native American Perspective, Challenging the Effects of Colonialism and Industrial Thinking. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent, coeducational undergraduate liberal arts institution, nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.